Episode 6, Conformity and Compliance, An Introduction to the Hidden Lessons of School. Critical thinking question. Suppose, hypothetically, that a very small group of people was trying to exercise power and control over a very large group of people. How dangerous would it be for the small group of people if they did not possess adequate tools for controlling the thoughts of people in the larger group?
Whole self.
You put your whole self in, you put your whole self out, you put your whole self in and you shake it all about.
You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about.
Backside.
You put your backside in, you put
Welcome
your backside.
School Sucks Podcast. This is Episode 6, Conformity and Compliance, An Introduction to the Hidden Lessons of School. You know, after I recorded the first episode of School Sucks Podcast, the introduction, I thought it would be wise to have another episode, maybe 10 to 15 minutes in length, explaining my views about politics and why I was opposed to using the political system to bring about change in education. Like I said, I thought that was something that I could deal with in 15 to 20 minutes tops. Well, here we are, 160 minutes later, finally ready to move beyond that subject. But at the end of the last episode, I asked a question. I wanted to know why so many people were willing to embrace or put their faith in a series of degrading and crippling ideas about the way society should be managed. I referred to these ideas throughout that episode as the authoritarian absurdities, the idea that you do not own yourself and it is okay for somebody else to claim ownership over you and your property. I was also curious about why so many people were seemingly ignorant about the philosophy of liberty, or totally unaware of it. And perhaps what's most baffling of all is that when you tell these same people about the philosophy of liberty, they get angry and attack you and try to rationalize the authoritarian absurdities. They'll say things like, Brett, don't you understand how stupid people are? We need what we have now because people are idiots. To which I might respond, adults are stupid? And they'd say, yeah, these people are everywhere. It's a majority of people. Then I might ask them, well, what's this whole 12-year government education thing all about then, if people who finish it are still stupid? Well, in today's episode, we're going to start answering those questions by exposing the embedded lessons in the curriculum of public education. I've been doing a lot of tutoring recently for a standardized test called the SAT. That's sort of the bread and butter of any tutoring business, unfortunately. Although I do think that the test has some good opportunities for kids to develop critical thinking skills that they would not learn through the process of public schooling. And I've been having discussions with groups of kids recently about this process of public education, and the consensus has been that school is sort of like this assembly line, where so much information goes by you, and you're an integral part of a machine, and you have to keep moving at this certain pace, and there's never really any time to pay attention to yourself as an individual or as a learner. As far as the amount of information that's thrown at you and what can be expected for retention, it's kind of like trying to drink out of a fire hose. But again, let's not mix metaphors. Let's stay with the factory thing. Because there are lessons in public education that we do retain. These skills would include basic reading abilities, functional writing abilities, and some elementary math skills, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, maybe some fractions, percents, all that good stuff. These are the skills that were necessary for factory labor in the 19th century. We don't retain much else. Sure, there's a few extracurriculars thrown in there, like the rules of dodgeball and how to put a condom on a banana, but most of the lessons that we take away from school, that we do retain, most people throughout their entire lives, are things that they don't even realize that they were ever taught. And that's what I want to focus on in these upcoming episodes. Am I a conspiracy theorist? Am I insane or overly paranoid because I suggest that the public education system in America might have some kind of other agenda than providing actual education to the American public? And would I really be going way off the deep end if I were to suggest that the actual agenda of public education now, and the actual agenda of public education since its inception, has been three primary goals? The first is to create reflexive obedience and fix responses in young people, as opposed to creative or inquisitive thinking. The second is to make children conform into easily controllable and predictable groups. And the third is to get children to forsake their individuality for the good of a larger group that they are supposedly a part of. If you were to answer yes, Brett, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist because you hold these views, the follow-up question that I might ask you is, then why did those three goals, as the true agenda of public education, accurately describe the society that we live in today? Now, I know most people aren't like big fans of history, or for that matter, learning in general. Thanks, public education. So let me sum up history in like 10 or 15 seconds. Human history is a continuous story that plays in a loop over and over again. A story of how a very small group of people controls a very large group of people, either by fear or by force. And this is achieved by keeping the large group relatively ignorant and hopelessly dependent on the supposed leadership of the smaller group. And in 21st century America, if you don't believe these rules apply to you, I'm sorry, but you have been fooled. All of America's social, cultural, political, and economic problems can be connected to a common denominator, the lack of real education. This is strange because after 12 years of schooling, we should all be really educated. If you do anything 180 days a year for a decade, you should be awesome at it. So that being said, maybe there's some definitions we need to clear up before we go any further. People often equate public school with education, and this is the first mistake. You see, education is a lifelong pursuit of personal growth, development, and new knowledge integration. Public school is not education. Public school is more like a processing plant where a creative and individualistic child goes in and eventually an obedient taxpayer slash citizen slash soldier is churned out. Public school is a process designed to turn children into followers, into people who will sort themselves into manageable and predictable groups, and who will surrender their self-ownership to the whims of strangers who do not care about them. This is not a conspiracy. This is Public Management 101. It reminds me of this movie that I watched, like, 46 times.
The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world, built to keep us under control in order to change a human being into this.
The point of the Matrix probably is to raise questions about our world. It's to make us think about our own world in slightly different ways, and maybe to make us ask questions about what the real limits and bounds on our own behavior are. You know, you see the scene at the end of the first movie where everyone's moving around in a sort of trance-like way, and Neo seems to be the only one that in that sense is awake in the phone box. But that notion of awakeness seems to me more like a social and political notion.
I don't look at the story of the Matrix as being literally a story of man versus technology. It's much more about the robots and the machines and the computers represent rigid thinking, the institutionalized control which people generally allow themselves to be subjected to.
You have a social critique on the outside, dialectical materialism that's sort of Marx filtered through Cornel West. But the irony is that in the Matrix, people are the means of production eventually. This great symbol of people being batteries. While they sleep, their bodies are actually batteries that power the city of the robots and this whole mechanical society. It's a very powerful symbol. Because people, you know, when they're completely asleep to what's going on around them, are exploited to that extent. They're giving up their very life force to run the society in a lot of ways. When we become passive consumerists, you know, we're surrendering our life force.
You are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch.
A prison for your mind, Morpheus tells him. Now you might be saying, oh my god, what a nerd. It was just like two episodes ago that this guy was comparing our society to the movie Star Wars, and now The Matrix? Well, I'm not the first person, and I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be the last, to use The Matrix as a metaphor for what goes on in our world. And people have tried to use this metaphor in different ways, but here's what I think is most important. We are trained to be passive and reflexively obedient to some sort of system of authority. Once that training is accomplished, and as it's perpetuated generation after generation, all kinds of unimaginable things become possible for that system of authority. As long as there is widespread reflexive obedience, it has no limitations. It has no checks against its power. People who can hide behind the legitimacy of that system can do whatever they want. And the people on the outside are just left rationalizing it, defending it, and most importantly, obediently following it. We, of course, are not lying in pools of goo with plugs running through our entire body, as was the case with the people in The Matrix. Our senses do not lie to us. We perceive the world largely as it is. Sure, there's infrared and ultraviolet light that we can't see. There's some frequencies on the spectrum of sound that our ears can't access, but we certainly know that those things are there. Our matrix is a psychological, an emotional one, because even though our perceptions, the sensory intake into our minds, are accurate, what we do with those perceptions is an emotional process. It's a psychological process. And because of what happens to us during our 12 years of public education, other people are guiding that process, are really in charge of that process for too many of us. In other words, our five senses, our sensory uptake, gives us reality. What happens next, what we do with that reality, is determined by our capacity for reason and logic. So the goal of public education seems to have been to disrupt that logical process, to instead insert some sort of pre-programmed conception of reality. So as we take in real information, it's organized into some other idea that's not reality, that's some kind of fictionalized, convenient version designed to help us rationalize, apologize for, and tolerate people exercising power and control over our lives. And this process was not new with public education in America. The public education system in America was borrowed from Prussia, as I spoke about in an earlier episode. Prussia, of course, the forerunner to the German state and the Third Reich, so we see how it worked out for them. But this is an idea that's thousands of years old. Before the Age of Reason, the people who were infecting the minds of human beings with these ideas of blind allegiance to authority were church people, were clergymen, who would rationalize the behavior of kings and emperors by saying that they were acting out the will of God. After the Age of Reason, the clergymen were just replaced with intellectuals and psychologists and educationists to accomplish the same goal. So even though the political leaders are the people who benefit from this process of public indoctrination or dumbing down of the human being, they are not the designers of the plan or the process. So today, just because this is an introduction, I thought it might be neat to identify some of the elitist intellectuals and central planners who were behind the design or the growth of the American public education system. But first, this.
John Taylor Gatto has been teaching in New York City schools for 26 years. Over these years, he has won the trust of his students, the resistance of many school administrators, and finally, the acknowledgement of various political forces that what he has to say merits hearing. On January 31st, 1990, as John Taylor Gatto accepted their award as New York City Teacher of the Year, New York State legislators listened. At the least, it must have been confronting. Gatto tossed no bouquets of roses to the nation's culture or its school system. Let me share with you some of what Gatto said. He is speaking to all of us. I've noticed a fascinating phenomenon in my years of teaching, that schools and schooling are increasingly irrelevant to the great enterprises of the planet. No one believes anymore that scientists are trained in science classes, or politicians in civics classes, or poets in English classes. The truth is that schools don't really teach anything except how to obey orders. It's not the fault of bad teachers or too little money spent. It's just impossible for education and schooling ever to be the same thing. Schools were designed by Horace Mann and by Sears and Harper of the University of Chicago and Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College and some others to be instruments of the scientific management of a mass population. Schools are intended to produce, through the application of formulae, human beings whose behavior can be predicted and controlled. Because community life, which protects the dependent and weak, is dead, and only networks remain, the only successful people in our national order are independent, self-reliant, confident, and individualistic. Well-schooled people are irrelevant. They can sell film and razor blades, push paper and talk on telephones, or sit mindlessly before a flickering computer terminal. But as human beings, they are useless. Useless to others and useless to themselves.
Now, I include this little piece about Jonathan Taylor Gatto for good reason. Gatto is one of the most outspoken critics of the public education system in America, and like the piece said, Gatto worked in public education in New York for nearly 30 years. So I wanted to read an excerpt from another piece that Gatto wrote called Against School, where he described some of this intellectual influence on the system that I have been talking about. One of the people that Gatto references is a intellectual named Alexander Inglis, who wrote a book in 1918 called The Principles of Secondary Education. So again, this is an account of that book given by Gatto in his short piece Against School, How Public Education Cripples Our Kids and Why. And it begins, Inglis, for whom a lecture in education at Harvard is named, makes it perfectly clear that compulsory schooling on this continent was intended to be just what it had been in Prussia in the 1820s. A fifth column into the burgeoning democratic movement that threatened to give the peasants and the proletarians a voice at the bargaining table. Modern industrialized compulsory schooling was to make a sort of surgical incision into the prospective unity of these underclasses. Divide children by subject, by age grading, by constant ranking on tests, and by many other more subtle means, and it was unlikely that the ignorant masses of mankind separated at childhood would ever reintegrate into a dangerous whole. Inglis breaks down the purpose, the actual purpose of modern schooling, into six basic functions, any one of which is enough to curl the hair of those innocent enough to believe the three traditional goals listed earlier. 1. The adjustive or adaptive function. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. This, of course, precludes critical judgment completely. It also pretty much destroys the idea that useful or interesting material should be taught, because you can't test for reflexive obedience until you know whether you can make kids learn and do foolish and boring things. 2. The integrating function. This might as well be called the conformity function, because its intention is to make children as alike as possible. People who conform are predictable, and this is of great use to those who wish to harness and manipulate a large labor force. 3. The diagnostic and directive function. School is meant to determine each student's proper social role. This is done by logging evidence mathematically and anecdotally on a cumulative record. Now, for today, I want to stop right there. I do hope in the future to read this article by Gatto in its entirety, but that's basically what we covered today, conformity and compliance. Now, you might be saying, Brett, this is just what some guy said about some guy. So maybe Gatto is just some kind of angry kook. I'd want to see and hear what Inglis actually said in the book. Well, I've got great news. I have the book right here, so let me read you a passage. And really, you know, any passage will do, because when I read anything that Inglis wrote in this book, the way he talks about human beings, it sounds like he's a zookeeper. It must further be recognized that the minimum level of general intelligence necessary in any society must depend on the amount of privilege conferred on the individual and the amount of responsibility placed on him. In a society where, for the majority of individuals, the great necessity is conformance to imposed demands, a much lower level of general intelligence is required than in a society where the individual must not only conform to social demands, but also must determine in part what those demands are. Wow. The entitlement and elitism of this guy just leaps off the page right into your face. Later in the book, he goes on to some of the functions that Gatto was discussing earlier. Two facts make this differentiating function in secondary education both possible and necessary. Number one, pupils in the secondary school, the raw material with which secondary education must perforce deal and which conditions its operation, differ greatly in native capacities, in acquired tendencies, especially as conditioned by training outside the school, in interest and aptitudes. Failure to recognize this fundamental fact at any time must inevitably mean failure to do justice to the individual and failure to develop the highest social efficiency out of the raw material available. Sounds like a lot of stuff being decided for individuals by strangers. So now maybe you're saying, all right, Gatto was right about Inglis, but who's to say that Inglis isn't some isolated quack? Surely he doesn't speak for the entire community of intellectuals and shadowy central planning elitists who design the public education system in America. So why don't we take some time to hear what a few of the others had to say? Horace Mann, who is considered the father of public education in America. He was the one who brought the system here from Prussia. You need not tell all the truth, unless to those who are right to know it all. That doesn't even make any sense, Horace. Let's try another one by him. Teaching is 1/10 as effective as training. You guys all know what training is. It's what you did with your dog. In 1888, the Senate Committee on Education, addressing recent public unrest, issued the following statement. We believe that education is one of the principal causes of discontent of late years manifesting itself among the laboring classes, basically asserting that as people learn more about government, they became more upset about government, and something needed to be done about that. In his 1905 dissertation for Columbia Teachers College, Elward Cubberley, the future Dean of Education at Stanford and a very influential educational thinker, said that schools should be factories, quote, in which raw products, children, are to be shaped and formed into finished products, manufactured like nails, and the specifications for manufacturing will come from government and industry. the Rockefeller Education Board in 1906. In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. Same Rockefeller Education Board in 1906. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, educators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for the embryo of great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple. We will organize children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things that their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. Those things that they're talking about are factory labor tasks. William Torrey Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education from 1889 to 1906. 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which scientifically defined is the subsumption or crushing of the individual. Harris again, in his book, The Philosophy of Education, 1906, the great purpose of school can be realized better in dark, airless, ugly places. It is to master the physical self, to transcend the beauty of nature. School should develop the power to withdraw from the external world. Woodrow Wilson, while he was president of Princeton University, addressing the New York City High School Teachers Association on January 9, 1909, 4 years before he became the President of the United States and started on his quest to become one of the worst people that the world has ever seen, said, quote, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks." William Godwin, in Inquiry Concerning Political Justice, 1793, so we're going back more here to even the earlier origins before Horace Mann, "Government will not fail to employ education to strengthen its hands and perpetuate its institutions." Benjamin Rush, a founding father and signer of the Declaration of Independence, "Let our pupil be taught that he does not belong to himself, but that he is public property. Let him be taught to love his family, but let him be taught at the same time that he must forsake and even forget them when the welfare of his country," whatever the hell that means, "requires it." John Dewey, another one of the famous, influential American educationist thinkers at the turn of the 20th century. Quote, "Every teacher should realize that he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of the proper social order and the securing of the right social growth." Dewey again, "You can't make socialists out of individualists. Children who know how to think for themselves spoil the harmony of the collective society which is coming, where everyone is interdependent." Archibald D. Murphy, the founder of the North Carolina Public Schools, quote, "In these schools, the precepts of morality and religion should be inculcated, and habits of subordination and obedience be formed. Their parents know not how to instruct them. The state, in the warmth of her affection and solicitude for their welfare, must take charge of those children and place them in school where their minds can be enlightened and their hearts trained to virtue." Finally, this is an excerpt from an article on Project Education Renovation entitled Crossing Education's Rubicon with Horace Mann. The same views were expressed by a group of prominent merchants from Essex County in Massachusetts, hence called the Essex Men. Quote, "The people must be taught to confide in and reverence for their rulers," said Stephen Higginson. Jonathan Jackson wanted, quote, "habits of subordination to a government of elite, which he believed all political power should be lodged." He viewed society as a, quote, "family," unquote, in which the, quote, "father," unquote, should firmly rule with each citizen, quote, learning his proper place and keeping to it. Maybe I'll end with one of my favorite and perhaps one of the most telling quotes about the public school system that I've ever heard. It's by Horace Mann. Quote, jails and prisons are the complement of schools. So many less you have of the latter, so many more you must have of the former. And you know what, Horace? What's the difference?
The Matrix succeeds in sucking in the viewer precisely in the same way that the Allegory of the Cave sucks in the reader. Allegory of the Cave appears in the central books of Plato's Republic. We discover that there are prisoners who have been bound from infancy to a single place in a dark underground cavern. What they see is the interior of a cave wall, and on it are projected shadowy images from a fire behind them.
These prisoners don't know they're prisoners, don't think they're prisoners. This is the only reality that they've ever known. This level of reality Plato and his mentor Socrates equate to the level of reality at bottom.
The life you've led is not in fact the totality of what is possible for you. And if you could release yourself from bonds you don't even see, you would then be able to see the world as it truly is.
Similarly, we have Neo's situation in the Matrix. We have Trinity and Morpheus reaching out to Neo, bringing him, through his own choice, into being unchained, or in this case, unplugged.
What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Perhaps the saddest part of the Allegory of the Cave, Plato's story about people who accept illusions as the totality of their reality, is that when one of the prisoners manages to free himself from the cave and see the world for what it actually is, upon his return, he's not only met with skepticism, but disdain and anger for bringing these realizations back to the cave. The reality for the people in the cave is the only reality they've ever known. And the fear and the emotional discomfort associated with having to admit that their entire life has been wrapped up in illusion is too much for most of them to bear. Public education is so effective because it gets to us all so early in our lives, teaching us conformity, compliance, blind allegiance, and obedience. It's the surrender of our minds, which inevitably leads to the transfer of ownership over ourselves to strangers. And in closing, I did not select today's bumper music to suggest that the Hokey Pokey itself is some kind of psychological conspiracy against children. But if you took the 12-year process of a public education and you condensed it into 1 4-minute song and dance, the Hokey Pokey, my friends, is what you would have. An exercise where unique and free-thinking individuals organize themselves into a uniform, homogeneous group and then passively await pointless and ridiculous commands. It's a song and a dance that we learn while we're in kindergarten. And boy, isn't that just such awesome preparation for what happens to us next? Put your whole self in to a large, irrational group, a collective that needs to be carefully managed and controlled and watched. And after 12 more years of that, you'll be ready for citizenship. Thanks, and take care.
It's all about, bitch!
Hello, friends of School Sucks. This is Brett Finott, the host of the show. I really hope that you've enjoyed the first 6 episodes of School Sucks podcast so far, and I hope you continue to do so. But I wanted to ask a couple of favors of the listeners, if they have the time. Both of these things are free, quick, and easy. The first is, if you have an iTunes account or if you use iTunes to download the show, please go to the iTunes page for School Sucks Podcast and leave comments there. It is extremely helpful for potential new listeners when they see that the show not only has other listeners, but those listeners give feedback. And the other thing is, and I think it's safe to assume at this point, that if you are a Homo sapien with a computer, that you probably have your own Facebook page. School Sucks Podcast also has a Facebook fan page. It was started about a week ago, and it's grown pretty quickly, so I'm very happy about that. But if you could go next time you're on Facebook, become a fan of the show there, and even leave a post on the wall, that would be terrific. In fact, if you're already members of groups or fan pages for things like Free Domain Radio, Free Talk Live, the Free State Project, Complete Liberty Podcast, we're actually only a few degrees of Facebook separation away from each other now. So again, thank you so much for all of the subscriptions and the downloads and all of the positive feedback so far. I really look forward to more. And where's the outrage? Where are the people who are absolutely furious with me? Please contact me. I will put you on the show and we can talk about it. Until then, take care.